I think we're back. We're back.
And is this sponsored by Heritage Foods today's show?
Heritage Foods hasn't sponsored anything here. I don't know what you're talking about.
I know, but it is a sponsor, you know. It should be sponsoring some.
How about a co-sponsorship between Roberta's and Heritage
Foods? So is Roberta's doing this one? Or wait, is Hearst Ranch doing this one?
No, we've been doing two-hour blocks with Roberta's.
Okay.
The last
yeah, Roberta's, you know, this is long overdue for them.
So Roberta's, my favorite restaurant in the city. I mean, really, Katie, it is one of the top five restaurants in the city. What are your top five restaurants in the city?
I don't have any.
Okay.
Because I never eat out, Patrick, because I cook.
I think Lupa's a top five restaurant for me.
Yeah?
Balthazar is a top five
restaurant. That's a great restaurant.
I think Bar Ballou, because of their charcuterie section, is a top five restaurant.
Yeah, that's a very nice place.
This is a little bit wild.
I like Bill Telepan's restaurant a lot.
I've been there. It's been a few years, but I have great respect for Bill. Antonucci's on the Upper East Side. And Roberta's.
Roberta's is...
It is a world-class restaurant, and everyone says that, not just me. Chefs come here. Rachel Ray was here the other day, and... I know we would love to have her on as
We'd
a guest.
We'd love to have her on as a guest. We would love to,
I would love
to
that too, actually.
Unpack Rachel Ray. That would be so cool. Get her to go back to the good old days when she was demonstrating foods in a grocery store chain in Albany, New York.
All right. So anyway, wait, we are... okay.
This is the main course part
Jack and I
Q.
just came up with a new segment for our shows.
Excellent.
It's a trash talk.
Oh, come
where
on.
We pick someone or something that has done something egregious. So on the last show,
really
it
egregious.
Was Scott Carlson
okay.
who had written an ignorant, unresearched, and he was writing for an academic journal and took it upon himself.
I know, but why do you think academia is not as subject to personal agendas as any other journalist?
Well, then they all get called out.
I mean, every publication has an editorial point of view. And
right, but you can't leave out a massive fact. You can't talk about,
sure
you know, Afghanistan. And you can't talk about Germany and not mention... Someone once did a German class at Vassar and didn't include the Holocaust. I mean, he didn't include that in the thing. You can't. You have to deal with reality. If you're writing an article on something, you have to write. So I would like you now, for part Q, call something out. Something or someone out. That has done something egregious. It could be a big company. It could be a small company. It could be a politician.
Okay, it's a politician.
Okay, who is it?
Dick Cheney.
Why?
Hands down.
How everyone loves that guy.
Well, I know I'm speaking to the converted here, but I think we all know that if there was anybody, like say for instance, the Clinton administration had called out Dick Cheney and Bush Jr. on their missteps and their foul-ups, the way that Cheney has attacked the Obama administration, even in the very first months of the administration. This would be pilloried in the press as, you know, anti-patriotic, anti-American, et cetera, et cetera. Instead of actually, the people I'm really calling out here is not Dick Cheney, because there's always going to be a Dick Cheney.
Okay.
But it's the American media, which has fallen into lockstep with the right wing. And the left wing, I have to say, is almost as equally egregious. In fact, the fact, what you're saying about Carlson...
Oh my God, I've unleashed a beast.
You have unleashed a beast, because what Carlson represents is what journalism has become in this country. It's a partisan enterprise. It's no longer about reporting the facts.
It's about
ratings.
It's
no longer about not having an agenda. It's about, you know, delivering your editorial point of view, no matter which side of the fence you fall down on. And that is not journalism.
We need Walter Cronkite back.
We do. We need Edward R. Murrow.
Who's like, I'm not going to cover
that.
I'm not going to cover that.
Yeah, right?
Well, then I'll cover it. But let me tell you, by the way, the Michael Jackson thing that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
This two kids had ever accused him. One, they settled out of court, so you don't know what happened. The second kid had done it before. He had accused another star of sexually abusing him and was threatened to get thrown in jail because it was a bold-faced lie. So if I was Walter Cronkite back in the day, they would have been like Michael Jackson for a second time has been accused by another kid 10 years later, who, by the way, did the same thing a few years ago. His parents did the same thing. That would have been enough. Or O.J. Simpson, for instance. I would have said to that, for instance, that one thing. I know this is a big jump. In the trial, I would have just said, you know, this is a guy. Is he innocent? Is he guilty? I don't know. But he wrote a I'm going to kill myself letter and got into a Jeep and tried to run to Mexico. That's it. It's right.
Well, not
there.
Only that, those but he stories had, have to he come had hundreds out. Of calls for protection from his wife.
Right.
On police record already. I mean, exactly. You know, and the fact so that you he have was acquitted to, is just
you need a discerning belief. Journalist who does some of the work for you. And we've had some guys on here who talked about that. And it's a very true thing. I think that the media has a moral obligation to decide what is and what isn't news.
Yeah. I agree. And I think that, the pandering to the salacious and prurient interests of New York, of the
ratings.
Generation is and ratings is egregious. And as a result, the country is suffering and we are having, we are seeing those results now in this, like, I mean, the idea that somebody like Sarah Palin could even be nominated for vice president, much less, you know, this is an ignorant woman.
And someone asked her, Katie Couric, what books do you read? And Katie Couric and Palin's response was, how dare you ask me that?
Right, right. I mean,
that's not a question that a presidential candidate can be asked. What books do you read?
Yeah.
She needs to get called out. And therefore, we have this section. It's the trash talk section, but it's not trash. It's like recycling trash. It's like good trash. But we are about to call people out because we do name names, mostly good, but also bad. So we have Scott Carlson and Dick Cheney.
And the American media. So that's three, actually.
Okay.
I want to find a journalist who doesn't subscribe to the ratings game. That's what I want to find.
Well, yeah. Once it became about ratings, I was very sad.
I want to find a guy who's not looking for the next big story. And that actually just, I know we have to take a break in a minute, but it also leads me to think about, on the way down here today, I was passing by a billboard in the subway station for Robin Williams' new show, Weapons of Self-Destruction.
And he's censored. He has a thing
over
his mouth.
And he's going to be competing with Carrie Fisher's
Fisher.
Sure, they're fine. They're both of them fine. But what I thought, I was thinking to myself, since when did being a junkie become so freaking interesting?
Like, you mean
I
like being
care.
A drug addict?
Yeah. When you're a junkie, you are a low piece of shit. I mean, you know, like you've reached the bottom. So why are we glorifying junkies by having off Broadway shows where everybody sees these, you know,
I think
highly
I might have to
public,
trash talk that.
Highly public figures who are, you know, on a certain level, even though they're talking about how terrible it was to be a junkie, at the same time, there's a certain glamorizing of being a junkie. And it's like a junkie is a boring son of a bitch, just the way a drunk is a boring son of a bitch. I mean, there is just nothing interesting
about
substance abuse.
Some substances, I mean, a lot of great religions, a lot of great songs, a lot of great acting gigs like Mork from Mork and Mindy were spawned from drugs. I think
okay,
maybe
they were fueled
we
by drugs,
embrace.
But I don't need to hear about your bad, you know, spiraling the drain, you know, how you hit rock bottom and woe is
funny,
me.
And if it's funny.
There's nothing funny about it, Patrick. I mean, they're able to make it funny. That's great. Keep it private, man. I don't want to hear about it. I don't want showing it on Broadway.
Keep your dirty laundry.
It's like you're
in
capitalizing on your. It's exploitation. It's just gross.
Okay,
it's egregious, right, Jack?
Okay.
Jack agrees.
We actually didn't get that last part on tape because we're too high on drugs in here.
Oh my god. They're like, there was a lot of scratchiness which came from breaking up
my
the
god.
Cocaine.
You guys, we got Frank on the phone because I know he's waiting. Okay, so we're going to take a quick break.
Then we're going to come back with Frank Reese and then
from Good Shepherd
with
Varun, and the politics of poultry.
Alice Waters is personal assistant after that.
I go by the name of Pharrell. I'm the Neptunes. And I just want to let y'all know.
I'm your pusher.
The world is about to feel something that they never felt before. Come on.
From ghetto to ghetto, the backyard to yard, I sell it whip on whip, it's off the hard, I'm the neighborhood pusher, call me subwoofer, cause I pump bass like that jack, on or off the track, I'm heavy cuz, ball to your fathers, you can duck to the Fetty Gov, sorry my love, but I'm seeing through these eyes, Benz convoys with the wagon on the side, only big boys keep deuces on the ride, Gucci Chuck Taylor with the dragon on the side. Man, I make a buck while I scram. I'm trying to show y'all who the fuck I am. The Jews is flirting. Be damned if I'm hurting. Legend in two games like I'm Pee Wee.
And we're back on the main course part Q on Heritage Radio Network. This is one of your two hosts, Thank goodness. I'm Katie Kiefer, and I'm here with Patrick Martins. Patrick has got his shades on, and he's fascinated by something that's happening out there. I guess everybody's playing with
it
his dogs.
It is so much fun to do radio because we're looking at this awesome restaurant.
Yeah, we're looking out a picture window at the back garden of Roberta's Restaurant, our sponsor for this hour, at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick. Come on down, people.
It's Roberta's. They also helped us build these studios out of two recycled shipping containers, and they helped build an Alice Waters-sponsored garden on the roof.
And later on in the show, we'll have Alice Waters' assistant, Varun, last name unknown.
But there would be, I think it's like Cher, just Varun. It's, there is, would be no heritage. There, the word would not exist. And this is a big thing that pisses me off. People forget who started that word. It was not me, although sometimes I get credit for that. It was a man by the name of Frank Reese, who not only introduced the word heritage, he also even got the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, to accept that as a term. Am I right, Frank?
Yep, we worked hard to make that happen.
Tell us about that, and welcome to the show. It is an
honor
to have you.
Thank you for joining us today, Frank.
You're welcome. It took a combination of a whole lot of people to get that to happen. But the main person that made it happen was the president of the American Poultry Association when they signed on to the definition of a heritage chicken. And as a result of that, once the USDA received that letter, we got approval the next day.
What is the definition of a heritage chicken?
Thank you, Patrick. I was just going to ask that.
The definition of a heritage chicken is a number of things. That the bird grows very slowly, that the mature weight for processing is 16 to 18 weeks, that the bird meets the standards of the American Poultry Association for breed definition, so that if you're going to put on the label that you are selling a Barred Rock or you're selling a New Hamp or you're selling a Jersey Giant, that the parents of that chicken, the breeding stock, meet all the standards of the American Poultry Association's definition of those breeds.
So they really basically embraced breed difference and diversity as a real thing by accepting that term.
Yes, very much so. I mean, by us putting, there's no other organization in the United States that has that authority nor that ability. You know, it's the oldest agricultural organization in America, founded in 1873.
This is the American Poultry Association.
Yes. Uh-huh. And their original purpose was to improve the quality of poultry in America, and their work started 140 years ago.
And what happened in the 40s and 50s? Did they lose their voice, or were they overtaken by greed and big industry? Or, like, how did they lose that voice? Or maybe they never lost it. But
they did lose their voice. Mm-hmm. It happened in the 50s. As farming left the individual farm and went into the factory farm system, as it went into the universities and it went into powerful corporations, who said, you know, we can improve the production, the bottom line. And so they, instead of having great diversity in poultry, they focused on one genetically engineered line of bird. Mm. And that slowly took over into what we have today. And once that happened, then the American Poultry Association no longer had a purpose.
And what do we have today?
There's one company that's basically controlling all the genetics worldwide, and that is Hubbard or Cobb, and they are the genetic designers. They give millions of dollars to our universities to do all the research and to develop these single line of chickens that are sold now by the billions worldwide, and that they like to call it the Cornish Rock.
Yeah,
but it's a long, long ways from its ancestor.
In fact, you sell like the Cornish, and yet it has Cornish Rock, and yet it has nothing to do with its industrial cousin, correct?
Yeah, we don't sell a Cornish Rock. Uh-huh. We sell an old English game Cornish, okay. The original Cornish chicken. Its ancestry is so old, we really don't know exactly. It is definitely a descendant of the wild jungle fowl and fighting fowl of the Middle East, but, you know, the English began to improve upon it. It was originally a fighting chicken, and they originally put those larger breasts on them so they had more muscle so they could fight. But
it was an Indonesian descent? Indonesian descent, Frank, way back?
Yes, Java, Indonesia, China, you know, that part of the world is where many of our original ancestries of our chickens came from.
I think it's important to bring people back to the 20th century in the sense that the reason why this particular breed has been experimented with and expanded and has become the breed of choice for big chicken processors like Tyson's is because of its rapid growing. So why don't we talk a little bit, because you were talking about the heritage breeds tend to take 14 to 16 weeks to get to market weight, whereas something like the Cornish rock hen, this is not the same thing as the rock Cornish game hen, and people should be recognizing that. Mm-hmm. But the Cornish rock hen, which is this industrialized breed, comes to market at about 7 weeks, right, Frank?
Faster than that. Some of them 5 weeks.
Uh-huh. So let's
42 days is the standard now.
I mean, that's incredible. And,
wow.
And there's a reason why. I mean, it means that they cost less to raise, right? Because you have less time to feed them. You have less time to house them. You can turn over the population a lot faster. So there's a lot of really great things in the sense of feeding America. But the downside to using a breed like this is that it pushes out all the heritage breeds. And what I wanted to chat with you for a minute about was, why is it important to keep heritage breeds alive? Why should we care? Why should the consumer want to pay more money for a heritage breed as opposed to, you know, $1.99 or a 99 cent per pound chicken like what Tyson sells? What's the reason for that?
There's many different reasons. One of them, I think, is just to keep biodiversity.
Mm-hmm.
Also, our chickens still have an immune system. You don't have to feed them tons of antibiotics to keep them alive.
Okay, so that's a key difference between heritage breeds and between these industrialized breeds. And I think that that's something that people don't really understand. Like,
and a big part of that, Frank, is can you speak to any of those studies from a factual, because I just quote this, but I'm not sure how it really worked. Didn't heritage breeds of poultry survive certain types of flus better than their industrial cousins?
Oh, yeah, it's been proved many times over. You know, I've had these barred rocks and these new hams for 50 years, and they have never had to have antibiotics.
Uh-huh.
They still have a natural immune system. Anytime you take an organism and breed it into a monosystem.
Right, and it's the same thing with corn or with potatoes.
Immunity,
right.
It's probably one of the saddest things that we've got, and yet our entire government and everybody worries about food safety. But, you know, it's so sad that with turkeys, chickens, that we now have to raise them in biosecurity. And people act as if that is something good. You know, actually, it's something really, really sad.
Well, in that movie,
we now have these animals that are so poor.
So fragile.
Poor health.
Right.
Well, they have to be raised in biosecurity.
Everybody saw, and if anybody who saw the movie Food, Inc., I think is aware of that, you know, the fact that you have to put on a hazmat suit to just go into the plant. And it's not because you, the person, might be infected, but it's rather because you, the person, might bring in some infection to the plant because the bird has no immunity.
Right.
That's,
so that's
right.
That's
and
probably
also because this animal is growing 300 times faster
than it should.
Than it normally should, than our birds do.
300 times faster.
You can imagine the stress that that is putting on that animal's, not only its skeletal system, but also its pulmonary and cardiac system. Mm-hmm. So it's no wonder it's under such stress.
Right.
You know, even if, let's say, you buy chickens that are free-ranged, organic, all-natural, Amish-raised, and whatever names you want to give them, and they... you have not changed that animal's genetics.
Mm.
It still grows at that rapid rate, even if, let's say, it takes 7 weeks instead of 5 weeks.
Uh-huh.
That's still not normal.
So, I mean, for instance, I remember chatting with Dan Barber not long ago from Stone Barns.
Although, Frank, you're not so happy with him, right, for his promoting of industrial genetics.
Yeah, because all of these people that are raising those birds are still buying all their genetics in the factory system.
I know, but Frank, the thing is that the factory birds are cheaper. And so how do you, I mean, the question I'm trying to get at and what I want people to understand about why supporting people like you is important, is if we don't all start supporting farmers like you as opposed to buying these industrialized monoculture type birds, then your prices are going to continue to remain very high. Let's talk a little bit about the economics.
Your prices are going to stay high
as long as you don't have the, or people like you don't have the industrial support. Right?
Well, the reason why our birds cost so much is not because of the bird.
It's because you've got to feed them for longer.
We can raise our birds just as cheap, if not cheaper, than they can. What we don't have is the infrastructure.
Slaughtering, which is all 80% slaughter, right?
And distribution.
Well, distribution they've got covered.
Because you are that.
If you were to take our chickens and raise them yourself, process them yourself, and put them in your freezer, you could feed our chickens to your family for 50 cents a pound.
Wow.
Where we get eaten alive is we do not have the ability to cut the real cost, and that is processing. You know, the big guys, Tyson is just one of the many companies.
Sure.
Actually, the Brazilians are taking over chickens worldwide.
No kidding. How interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have you back to talk about that another time.
But they can process a chicken for 35 cents.
Uh-huh. Because of their cheap labor costs.
$3.
Why does it cost you $3?
Because we have a small little plant where everything has to be done by hand. And any time you have to do things by hand, labor eats you up.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not processing 30,000 chickens a day.
Right.
How many are you? You're doing 500 every week, right?
Every 2 weeks. And so it costs us the same to open up and pay for those employees if you're doing 500 chickens or if you're doing 5,000.
Which is a big thing for your turkeys also, Frank, right?
I mean, that's the same thing. The turkeys are a different issue. The turkeys, we can never compete because they do so many things artificially that we don't. It costs us so much. They can hatch a baby turkey for 90 cents.
Uh-huh.
For us to hatch a baby turkey, just to get the turkey out of the egg and out there, is $8.
Wow. Why is that, Frank?
Because we naturally mate. Everything is artificially inseminated.
Uh-huh.
We do not force our turkeys to lay all year round. We do not force them to lay out of season.
You allow them to roost. You don't cut their beaks off. I mean, there's a lot of things you don't do.
Yeah. And plus, our turkeys are only in production for about 3 months out of the entire year.
Uh-huh.
So that means, you know, 9 other months out of the year, we're feeding these breeder turkeys that are not producing a dime.
Right. And you can't sell turkey eggs if they're not.
No.
Right.
And so to do everything truly sustainable, naturally, is very expensive when it comes to turkeys. Mm-hmm. Now, chickens is different. Our chickens lay all year round. We don't force them to lay. You know, they naturally do it. Plus, well, the industry, no turkey lives past one.
Oh, man.
Once the hen is finished laying, she's killed.
Uh-huh.
Because in the industry, you do not keep any animal that is not producing money.
Right, of course. But that makes sense even on a farm. I mean, come on.
Well.
Yes. I mean, you're not keeping animals to be friends with them.
It still produces, but maybe not as hardcore.
What does it produce? After it can't lay eggs anymore, then you have to kill it.
No, it can still lay eggs. It's just taking a break, right?
It's taking a break. You're exactly right.
Really?
During it's like you go on vacation, they kill you. So I want to ask, Frank, part of the reason we have about 10 minutes
more. What we're going to do to Jack and Nat.
How did the turkey project go? We actually were at Roberta's, and these two people came out to their garden area, and they were like, what is this, a radio studio? And they were like, it's Heritage. And they were like, oh, my God, you know, we got one of their turkeys, and it was delicious. They were like, why was it frozen? But that was partially just because of the slaughter date and all that. But, I mean, trying to stay a little positive, give us the state of how did the turkey project go this year.
How'd your turkey business go?
Well, we had a lot of struggles this year, and one of the biggest ones is we lost the use of our plant that we were going to in Nebraska.
Which was a cooperative slaughterhouse called Norbest, correct?
Well, it's the Nebraska Turkey Growers. They were just contracted to Norbest.
Okay.
But all those companies are all getting slowly bought out, and there's only going to be one or two companies in the whole world.
Who's buying them?
either West Liberty, the Brazilians are buying up everything. Cargill, there's going to be very few companies left.
And so and that those was companies, a big challenge.
Wait, let's never heard of.
Let's go back to a second. All those companies, companies like Cargill, those are the companies that control the slaughtering and processing facilities, right?
Yes,
and that's what's making. Arms. And they are not. They are not open to working with producers like yourself, or that's not true.
No, because we don't fit into their monosystem at all. Mm-hmm.
In other words, they're going to pick and choose like which producers. Like if you don't, it's like Monsanto. If you don't use my grain, you can't use my fertilizer.
They're not that many people like Frank.
I know there's nobody like Frank, obviously.
No, but there's. I mean, even in terms of numbers, you're either producing 50 or 70, or you're producing 20,000.
20 million.
Yeah, that 10,000-20,000 number. There's just not many of. There's not that much of a market.
Frank, how could you lower your price?
Right. All the turkeys and chickens are now raised on mega farms.
Well,
everybody who is managing the turkeys and the chickens that you buy in the grocery store come from mega farms. They're all employees.
Well, what keeps you going, Frank?
Just bullheadedness.
I wanted, before we wrap up with you, and we have another guest.
Question after you.
And actually, we might have to have you come back to talk about this. Remember I sent you that little thing from meetingplace.com, Yvonne Vizier Thaxton, talking, yes. And she mentions you, she read about you. She is a blogger on meetingplace.com.
What did she say?
Well, she says, here we go. She says, she opens up the article by saying, I applaud anyone that can find a new market for poultry and figure out a way to make money, especially if it is good for the environment and animals. Therefore, I am a fan of Frank Reese Jr., who owns and operates Good Shepherd Turkey Ranch Incorporated. However, I'm not likely to ever have an opportunity to taste one of his turkeys as I cannot justify the price with my budget. So he, you know, she goes on and on about, you know, what you have.
She must be dirt poor. Oh yeah, she's really poor. Once a year.
I mean, after all, she is the mouthpiece of the poultry industry. I think we know who's paying those paychecks. So she says, she goes on to say, that's wonderful. You know, we need to preserve these beautiful birds while we can. I'm certain that it is correct, as these birds would be too expensive to keep for novelty pets, and they are beautiful. And some very famous chefs have commended the flavor of these products. However, these are those who say, I mean, I got to say the grammar on some of these things are incredible. These are those who say that this is the future of poultry, but I have to point out that I found Mr. Reese through Farm Forward, which wants to eliminate meat from our diets. This ironic
endorsement. Is that true, Frank?
I doubt it. This ironic. The meat industry is the most paranoid industry of any that I have ever dealt with. This ironic endorsement caused me to rethink the issue. Do you think that it could be a clever way to influence public perception? If this is the only way to raise poultry and it is too expensive for the average person to buy, what's next?
Okay, so Frank, what do you think about this woman? I mean, well, how did you react?
My first response is, if people think it's too expensive, you will either pay now or you're going to pay later.
I think that's a very important point. It's you can pay now.
You can go ahead and continue to buy the cheap food.
That's right.
The problem
and you will reap the benefits
that we are offering. They are nothing new. They fed this world for hundreds of years.
The problem is that we have a lot more people now than we used to. And I think that's where people like you, Frank, are you know, sort of like it's the tipping point, as Malcolm Gladwell would say, because we all want to eat what you have, but we can't all afford to eat what you have.
Well, once a year, a year, I think 98% of the population can. To say
no, 98% can't.
Once a year, I think they can.
Yes, really not.
96.
No.
95.
Maybe 30.
Oh, no, once a year? Come on. I don't buy that. I won't get co-opted by this nation's poorest percentage that I can't say that 99% sneakers, Walkman, they absolutely can. Do they choose to spend $80 on a turkey if they go to Fairway? I don't know if they choose to, but can they? I think absolutely yes. This nation is not composed of poor people. I'm talking about a once a year thing where they're spending $4 a person or $5 a person per portion. Sorry, I don't buy it. They can.
Okay.
And I also don't buy that Frank is a threat. to the meat industry.
He's so not a threat, which is what I found incredible, that they even brought his name up.
Although Frank talked about...
Although it shows how much of a threat they consider you to be, Frank.
They used to accuse him of having biohazard issues on his farm. He had like the cleanest farm of all time. I mean, anyway, it is very upsetting. That
it's not upsetting. It means that Frank is making an impact.
But the prices of these birds, you know, that they keep focusing on that. And that was one of the things that bothered me a lot about what Dan Barber wrote in the article in Men's Health, where he compared our turkeys to the butterball turkeys, which were $1.10 a pound, and ours were $10 a pound.
Right.
You know, but people don't realize is that $10, you know, 60% of that is the postage.
Right, that's because people choose to get a FedEx.
We aren't getting $10 a pound for the turkeys.
Right.
And you know, $10 a pound,
you're shipping a 20-pound package overnight.
$10
the problem is not the turkeys. The problem is the distributing
mechanism.
McDonald's costs $10 a person.
The system in this country that used to be here, which every state had had farmers raising the animals that fed them in their county.
And is Dan Barber talking about cheap food and democracy? He had a Rockefeller grant that allowed him to open Stone Barns. Like, I don't buy it. $8, McDonald's costs $8 a person. Argument over. It's the same price as McDonald's if you were to go eat a meal.
That is true. McDonald's is not cheap anymore.
No more. It's over. Applebee's, Sonic Burger cost $12 a person if you get fries and dessert. So it's over. It's done. A turkey from Frank is cheaper than McDonald's. End of the elitist story.
And you
we're
can
talking
make
about
many
once
more meals
a year,
out of it.
Once a year.
Yeah, because it's not just your roast turkey for Thanksgiving dinner. It's the turkey sandwiches. It's the turkey soup. It's
and
the turkey tetrazzini,
people,
the turkey mole. It's everything
and
else
And the alternative
make
is unhealthy. So poor people should not eat unhealthy food.
Well, let's not even
we
go
need
there.
To figure
it's like,
out
what tastes
another way.
Good?
Yeah, I don't know. I get very worked up that they
you
come
do.
Out and get Frank, of all people,
I know.
The one success story in America, that people have to come out and shoot that down.
But that just shows how threatening Frank's model is. Right, Frank?
Well, that and I really, honestly, you know, all these people want animal rights and they want sustainable food and they want healthy food unless it affects their pocketbook.
Yeah, people are greedy.
There we go.
People are greedy.
And that's the thing. I mean, I think that's, I mean, Frank, I hope you'll come back and talk to us again because we probably need to take a break and bring our last guest on. Varun is coming from Alice Waters. So, but Frank, please come back and talk to us again about the issues around slaughterhouses and distribution and why that adds so much cost to raising birds like yours, which, you know, really could be much more economically viable if we had the infrastructure to support that kind of enterprise. And that's really where we need to focus our energies in terms of the community that is interested in improving the quality of food in the country. Mm-hmm. We need to be really focusing not so much on farmers like you. I mean, not that you don't deserve support, but we need to be creating a place where you guys can process your products and get your products into the mainstream.
We need an alternative. And I like what we said. Don't go to McDonald's. Buy poultry from Frank Reese because it costs the same.
That's right.
Even with FedEx.
Frank, we love you and thank you so much. This is
Frank
Reese has been on the show from Good Shepherd Farms in Kansas. And we'll be talking to you again, Frank. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Ciao, man.
Thank you.
gotta quit. Was a man I hated more. Never was a boss I hated more. I hate his right hand man. I hate his left boy. The throne still outweighs the cons. 2-1. So I serve my time and get my money.
And we're back. This is the Main Courts Part Q on Heritage Radio Network. We are located in the back garden of Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn, 261 Moore Street. Come on down to Roberta's. If you're in the New York City area, it's one of the top five restaurants here. That's what Patrick keeps saying. And personally, I would believe it. And also, the energy
the
here
food is delicious.
Like, the food is really great.
It's
I mean, not only do they have the great wood-fired pizzas, but they also have a really, really talented kitchen staff. And they're just churning out some really terrific, amazing foods.
Great pork chops.
Yeah, great pork chops. Great grits. Great eggs, great bacon.
It's well informed. It's a highly cultured, sophisticated cuisine.
It is. And they're growing cheap. A lot of their own vegetables on top of the shipping containers in which this radio station, Heritage Radio Network, is based. And we are privileged to have the right-hand man of Alice Waters, the benefactor of those gardens, here in the studio with us today. Welcome to Varun. Varun, are you like Prince with no second name?
Or
Madonna?
Exactly. Just
it's
Varun.
Just Varun. Yeah, Varun. So Varun, give us the inside skinny man. Like, how you're really young dude, so like how did you get that job? Well, I mean, I want that job.
I'm actually from New York, and
I thought you were from New Jersey.
Well, from New Jersey, but then
no, just kidding, that's the same.
The usual I don't know, annoyance of being from New Jersey and saying you're from New York.
But, that's fine.
But I went to NYU, and then I was working in the city for an olive importer right after college. And then kind of when I was ready to leave, I was scouring Craigslist for all kinds of jobs. And I was actually a business major in college. So mm-hmm. I majored in marketing and finance.
Where did you go to college?
NYU.
At NYU.
NYU, okay.
And so while I was in college, I worked at the French Culinary Institute. And mm-hmm. then that's how I kind of got my job after school
with
ended.
The olive importer.
The olive importer.
Right.
Well, who is this nameless olive importer?
Food Match.
Food
Match importer. And they have Divina and Barnier Fresh Harvest, which I actually saw some Barnier buckets back in Roberta's.
Oh, okay.
Cool.
So I was scouring Craigslist, and I applied to maybe 100 jobs all over the place. And where I heard back from was Chez Panisse, which I knew a little bit about before I got there.
So they advertised on Craigslist?
They advertised on Craigslist. That is too cool. So for those of you who are looking for jobs, please.
It was an internship.
The coolest jobs ever.
In Alice Waters' office on Craigslist.
Wow.
And so I'd seen the one Kim Severson, New York Times piece that she had done where she went to the market with Alice and walked
great
around everywhere.
Great article, I remember.
Yeah. And so she had gone to the market and everything. That was kind of the one thing I knew about Alice. And working at the French Culinary Institute, she was the dean of sustainability there, I think, when I was working there. So I knew a little bit about her, but not all that much. And they called back, and I was doing my research as I was going along with this interview process. And then I just ended up kind of going out there on a whim for a 3-month unpaid volunteer internship.
3 months unpaid.
You know what? It's worth doing that stuff. It actually is.
Being an unpaid volunteer.
My sister-in-law is doing a lot of unpaid internships right now, and they're very valuable.
It totally is. And then, you know, about 2 weeks into it, it was just the timing was right. And Alice shook me by the shoulders.
Adorable.
What were your jobs? I mean, as an unpaid intern, were you going to Bob Kennard's farm and picking up deliveries?
The thing about being an unpaid intern at Chez Panisse and Alice's office is that the second day, Alice gives you the keys to her house and she's like, go grab this for me. You know, like she's an open book from the very first day.
Uh-huh.
And
there are hundreds of interns and chefs. Yeah, I mean, her network is a big one.
There's intern opportunities from anywhere, from the wine room to the kitchen to the office, everywhere. Mm-hmm. And our most recent intern was a kitchen intern and a community college student who just kind of walked into the office and said, I want the internship, and we gave it to her. But
wow.
Yeah, so it was
you were doing everything from going to her house to pick something up to hosting guests,
answering the phone. And then about 2 weeks into it, it just so happened that the two people that were working in the office kind of were on their way out.
Sylvan Brackett?
No, Sylvan was the creative director of Chez Panisse at the time. But there were two people who were working mainly on Slow Food Nation. And then Joyce Sellers is who interviewed me. Mm. And Joyce now works at the Intervale Center in Burlington, which is a great little farm.
Cooperative.
Cooperative landlord kind of. Yeah. Position
they
in,
let
in
other
Burlington.
Farmers yeah. work that land and produce for themselves. Pretty cool.
And they produce all the organic produce that's grown within the city limits of Burlington and sold at the farmers markets. And
wow,
yeah. So I worked with Joyce for a little while, and then about a month into it, I was just on my own in the office, and Alice just was forced to trust me.
Well, let
everything.
Me ask you, all the Chez Panisse employees have a certain style about them. Like, you can call 100 other important places in the food world or any world, really, and you get some snotty little kid and you don't know. Like, how do they teach you that that they are a national landmark of sorts and a go-between for all these types of ideas and stuff? How do they teach
and
you the
Chez Panisse?
And
there's so much political action going on there, too. So there's...
It's like a language immersion program. You know, when you're studying Spanish and just have to go to Spain and only speak Spanish, that's like what it's like going to Chez Panisse, is that you're just immersed in it. And there's no, I don't know, there's nobody teaching you exactly what to do or what not to do. But it's definitely a learning experience from the very minute that you walk up the ramp into the back, where the farm order's coming in from Bob Kennard's farm, and you're seeing just how different the process is there of buying produce and buying meat and how everything works there.
Very interesting. And so now you are her right-hand person. So now tell us about some of the exciting people.
What are the projects that you're involved with? Alice Waters and Chez Panisse are like at the forefront of the whole school lunch thing. And
I know. And the minute I walked into the program, it was into Chez Panisse, it was kind of the biggest year and a half of Alice's life. I started about a month before Slow Food Nation,
which was a big 100,000 person event in all of San Francisco.
Exactly. And so since then, we've done dinners at the inauguration. Alice has gotten her honorary degree at Princeton. We've had major meetings with all sorts of people, and she's in Europe right now. She screened Food Inc. for the Prince of Wales. And you're in the office and you're involved with every and any project that's going on in her life.
Yeah.
So,
and which is myriad and multitudinous, huge.
So a lot of what I've been doing in New York is there's this project going on at PS 216 in Brooklyn, on Avenue X. And they're in this stage of fundraising right now for a pretty major school garden at the middle school there.
Right.
And so they are, in that initial really tough phase of doing the community meetings and getting the principals on board, but getting the community on board and
getting the parents involved
and having people understand what the worth of converting a parking lot into a garden would be at a public school.
And what would that be? What is that worth? It's like bringing the kids start tending the garden.
The kids start tending the garden and they start learning how to cook.
So that exposes them to fresh produce.
That exposes them to fresh produce. Then it also exposes the parents and the families to fresh produce. And the kids eat together at a table and they want to do the same thing at home. And
it's so much more inspiring than cement.
Yeah, so much more inspiring.
It's alive.
And it's been happening in Berkeley since, I guess, 13 or 14
doing it
years.
For a long time.
Martin Luther King Middle School, right?
Yeah.
I mean, was one of the first models of allowing students not only to eat fresh produce, but to be involved in the growing of it, which is real like a gym class once a week, but every student is there getting their hands dirty. It's kind
and
of
so
fun.
it was a 1 acre piece of pavement before they really started. And then from the 1 acre piece of pavement, you now have hundreds of different kinds of produce and chickens and students from 6th, 7th, and 8th grade that are there every week in the garden, in the kitchen, learning how to cook. And it's they have an AmeriCorps volunteer right now that's there for a year who actually was one of the first students to be involved in the garden.
Wow. Yeah.
How are they going to teach kids how to cook? I mean, I'm always curious about that, being a cook myself. And I haven't managed to teach my own child how to cook. So,
okay, well, one of the fun things, one of the fun things about my job is that about a month ago, I got to be a judge at Iron Chef Middle School, Iron Chef Luther King.
Excellent.
So they had all this, a basket of produce each for the garden, from the garden. And then they basically each there were three teams, and they each had to cook something from the garden. And I was just watching them in awe. They were, within 30 minutes, they had come up with a 3-course menu from, I think their ingredients were, you know, a boiled potato and some onion, some garlic, a melon, which one of the girls was like, what the hell is this thing? Mm-hmm. And she, they thought it was a squash the whole time, so they put it in their stir fry, which was kind of gross. But
so she didn't win?
Well, no, unfortunately, my team didn't win. But
so you were a judge?
I was a judge, and there were three judges and three teams.
Oh, I
That's
see.
Fabulous.
And but just the things they could do. I mean, my team, they took this boiled potato and cut up onions and garlic and made mashed potato onions with onions and garlic kind of mixed in and shallow fried them. These are sixth graders.
Yeah.
That made little mashed potato balls and
great.
Yeah. And
absolutely.
So they're learning
what
how
could
to
be
cook
better than that?
Very straight from the garden.
It's so, just like my boyfriend Curtis.
I have a very interesting question that's exactly, I mean, if there is a skill to being, you know, a right-hand person for someone important, is I'm so happy you told me this. I hope it's okay I'm saying it on air. Hug and release. Tell us about what is hug and release.
Oh, that's great, Patrick. Thanks for bringing that up. That's lovely.
Well, you know, part of what we do in Alice's office is that you get anything from fan mail to a speaking request to a quote request to a book request to a job, you know, interview or resume, anything. So a lot of it is putting these people in the right places and then letting them free to do their own thing. So it's a hug and release process, because these are people who want to do, they want to work, they want to volunteer in a public school program like the Edible Schoolyard, and they want to work at a restaurant that's buying locally and organically. Mm-hmm. And, but you know, Alice is one person.
Yeah, you can't do it all.
And we're an office of 2.5 people, and
You can't say yes to everyone either.
Yeah, you can't say yes to everyone. So
can hug everyone.
Yeah. So hug and release, it's a really kind of, it's a good way, I think, of looking at it when you can't give someone an hour of Alice's time, mm-hmm. and you have to lead them on the right track. That's when we hug and release.
Hug and release. It's great.
But in a way, that's what mentoring is all about.
Yeah.
Mentoring is hugging and releasing. I mean, Eric Ribeiro does it in his kitchen all the time. It's like he hugs his sous chef and then he releases them to open a new restaurant.
and it's a way to to promote longevity of your program, is to mm-hmm. get people to do their
Absolutely.
Own thing on their own.
And without the hug, they cease to care. And especially with someone like Alice, who's very famous, people hate it if that person doesn't, if they don't get that hug, you know, they get so ticked off, you know, like everyone's like, oh, she's mean. Sometimes it's just that they didn't hug the person for that 1 second, even if it comes through you or someone
else.
The one
person out of 100 that we don't hug never fails to come back to us.
Oh man, me too. Right? I deal with 500 people in a, you know, in my world, week in and week out, to sell all this stuff. One bad thing, and man, it's the whole thing. And I'm like, listen, there's another 499 people that are, you know, totally been hugged. But it is an art form to do that.
It is.
What have you learned from working at Chez Panisse?
Oh, everything. I mean, it was a life-changing experience to work there and to be there for. I've learned a lot about the media, working for, you know, a public persona, and
That's another whole program.
Do you guys handle them or do they handle you?
Yeah, so Alice doesn't have a PR agency or a speakers bureau or anything. So we take all the requests through the office. Oh, we have a caller.
Speaking of...
We have a caller. What does the caller have to ask?
No, it's my daughter.
She's not asking about the show?
She's not supposed to be.
You're supposed to shut your phones off before entering the studio.
I know, I'm sorry. I had it on because I wanted to read this thing from Yvonne Thaxton Vizier or whatever her name was. We didn't do it.
On the meeting place.
What were we talking about?
So we were talking about...
the media.
Yeah, the media. So... Do you pick and choose who's going to write your stories? Like, let's say someone's I want to do a Lifetime Achievement Award for the Pittsburgh Gazette. Do you guys say, no, you're not the right person to do that in Pittsburgh?
There's a process of taking the 20 requests that come in a week and presenting a few of them to Alice, you know, because you can't present every single one.
How do you filter that? That's my next question. But anyway, finish your thought.
So then, you know, out of those five, Alice and I have this little thing called the note, and we have... this note that we go over every day almost that has, you know, the requests that came in and what she wants to do and what she doesn't want to do. So it's really a collaborative process between us. And the longer I've worked there, the more I'm able to filter.
I mean, do you ever worry, shit, you might need to know this? Or, I mean, how did you learn that? That's a fine line.
You filter with friends, you don't filter. You don't filter her friends out in any way. And with certain media outlets, you don't filter. You know, if the New York Times is calling,
right, or the BBC,
the New York Times back.
Yes,
and then from there, you work on your intuition and you work on what you know from knowing her and knowing Chez Panisse and knowing where it's going.
How did she learn to trust you? How does she trust people? I mean, besides giving the keys to her house, I mean, she doesn't trust a filter very easily.
Alice surprisingly has a very large inner circle. Sometimes people, when they get to that level of fame or notoriety, have to, I don't know,
downsize
their inner circle. But hers just seems to keep getting bigger and bigger. And it's part of her personality.
She's a hippie.
Well, Chez Panisse was a collaboration from the beginning.
It's always been a collaborative process. And all of her books are a collaborative process. And so just by that nature, the office is a very collaborative process. Mm-hmm.
So it makes it easier for you to come in and know what's right and what's wrong, because you're not operating in a vacuum of three or four people.
Exactly. And there's always feedback from Alice, and she'll always tell you what she thinks and what she doesn't think. And
how involved is she? Is she involved? Is her tendency micromanage?
When Alice is in Berkeley, she's at the restaurant basically every day. And her way of staying there and staying in touch with the cooks, with the office, of everything, is to eat there and to be in the office and be present. And that's when she's in town, she's there
all
the time.
That's how you keep your restaurant quality up.
She actually, her office is very new. It was just, she just got her own office.
She's not in that nice communal room anymore?
No. I took over the communal room.
Oh, nice. And now, Varun, you've kicked Alice out. You filtered Alice.
She has her own office now that used to be a therapist's office, which I think is kind of funny. But it's right around the corner from her old office. But she used to share an office with someone else, which I think is kind of funny about.
I share my home and office with three other people. Well, that's cool. So anything exciting that you want to tell us about? We have 4 or 5 more minutes.
Well, Alice is in Europe right now. She's in Rome.
And with Mona?
She's with Mona. I think she's headed to France today. She's going to eat at El Bulli.
Oh, El Bulli. Wow. Ferran Adrià.
Yeah. She was kind of very nervous to eat there after I told her that it was 40 courses starting at 10:30 p.m.
Oh, Lord. That is so funny.
She calls it chef torture sometimes when she's just like given the tasting menu of all tasting menus.
It's so funny because Carlo Petrini went there and was expecting really not to like it.
And he loved it, right?
Loved it.
So Alice, last week she did, she spoke at an event with Carlo Petrini with the mayor of Rome.
Okay.
For the 20th or 25th anniversary of Slow Food.
Oh, wow.
I think it was this past week.
89, 2009, 20 years.
So she was just planning to have a low-key week in Rome, but she ended up speaking to 10,000 people with Carlo Petrini.
Yeah, exactly. Low-key Alice and Carlo.
That is low-key for Alice, isn't it?
Well, she is an international vice president of Slow Food. I remember when I first had to open the Berkeley chapter, actually, speaking to the importance of someone like Varun, it wasn't Alice that started the chapter. It was one of his predecessors, Christina Salas Porras, who sent a little FedEx package with 80 memberships in it, which was what we had listed as the minimum necessary. I think it was 60. But of course, if one person signed up, we would have started the chapter. But like, she got us all the 60, which were very important people. Yeah. You know, Marion Cunningham, Paula Wolfer, you know, all these types mm-hmm. of people. And they had all signed up for the Berkeley chapter. So, yeah, it was a very...
And the Berkeley chapter is booming.
Right? Is it? So. What are you a member?
No, not. I should be. You've outed me as a non-Berkeley celebrity.
That wasn't a hug. That was just the release.
Exactly. I should be a Berkeley member, but I live in San Francisco.
But why? So. I mean, you're already in the whole process.
I know. My donation to Slow Food is a lot of time.
I know.
Yeah.
A lot of time.
I know how much your office probably has to do for Slow Food.
Yeah, it's and we lot. Have someone working in our office, a new person, David Pryor, who worked at the Slow Food international office with Carlo.
Oh, very interesting.
He's kind of going to be our Slow Food ambassador.
And tell us about Renato. Renato Sardo, an old Slow Food person, is head of the international office, is doing this big thing at Jack London Square. What's the news on Jack London Square? Massive urban project.
Yeah, so Jack London Square is going to be, I guess, the East Bay's version of the Ferry Plaza, which is mm-hmm. Where the farmer's market is held every Saturday and Tuesday and Thursday in San Francisco. And there's a demand for it in the East Bay. So mm-hmm. I think that's what he's kind of capitalizing on right now. And with what they've learned from Slow Food Nation and putting on events, and he's married to Anya Fernald, who is the director of Slow Food Nation.
Yeah. We had them on those.
Yeah.
They
did a big, street food festival.
The Eat Real Festival.
That sounded cool. I'm sorry. I missed that.
I was out of town that weekend. I missed it too.
Well, Varun, this has been great. I hope you call in, and you should have a little Varun segment, I think, on the main course part queue.
I'm all for having these repeat guests. Because
just the
I think
things,
it lets
5 minutes,
understand
10 minutes,
that
15 minutes.
Well,
these are,
I love
these
Roberta.
These are not flash in the pan events. These are things that are ongoing.
And these
programs.
Are not flash of the pan issues either.
Right. And it's like you need to check in with them on a regular basis to see what's happening.
Absolutely.
And I think that's a really important part
it also
of our
makes
programming.
Our booking department a lot easier.
It does, just doesn't it? Funny like, thing about that, Patrick.
Varun, can you come on next week? No, yeah. just kidding.
But, yeah, no, well, we'll be doing
I'm going back to Berkeley on Friday.
Well, you can do phone in, so in a few weeks.
I will phone in. I love Roberta.
Once a month,
so
you should come
for
call
in.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Even by phone, Roberta's tastes good. So, okay.
Well, invite me and I'll be here.
Awesome.
We'll do it. This has been the main course part Q.
Yeah, and we're engineered by Jack Inslee, who is going to this Thursday with me be picking new sound effects. And I was thinking one sound effect would be really cool is monks. I was thinking
chanting.
About it with the Greg Hall, like, whoa, like Gregorian chant kind
I'd be
of.
Be all for that.
You know, yeah. It's very
we're
religious.
We're actually engineered by Nat Wiener.
And we're engineered produced. By Rectech. That's his nickname.
Wait, you're going to get sound effects?
No,
monks?
We're not going to talk
here,
about
look,
Rectech.
Yes, but we have, these are some sound effects. I've lost Wait. My cue card of which each one is, so
I
it's
hear
random.
This is Joe Bastianich, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Okay. That'll do now. That'll do, pig.
We will be back next week.
And I just want to let y'all know, I'm your pusher. The world is about to feel something that they never felt before.